Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're glad you made it here tonight, because you're gonna miss out. You can tell your friend tomorrow that they're gonna miss out on a damn good thing we're gonna give you tonight. Yeah, right on. What we gonna give you tonight, it'll be down to the nitty gritty. Yeah. You can tell all your friends way over in hell, I don't care. You can tell them in over in Watts. You can tell them they met. You can tell them tonight that Santa Monica has been definitely set on fire. And they met on a damn good thing. The best thing ever happened to Santa Monica is gonna be here tonight. Yeah. And you can also, all you little old pretty one, huh? If he ain't here tonight, huh? You can tell him forget it too, you know, because Mr. Whatever is here tonight. He gonna get down tonight, brother. He gonna get with it. He gonna give you something that Santa Monica that never had. If it good to you, it gotta be good for you. Right on. Yeah. And one thing I can tell you, brother, he is here tonight. Mr. Magnificent One is here. The beautiful one is here. You little old pretty one, you here too, you know, whatever. Here is the magnificent one, the one and only one, Mr. Stilly Danny, whatever.
What is up? What's happening by the hand? What is up? What's happening?
This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the core.
Hi everyone, this is Infant Scott speaking, or as some know me, 4.8. You haven't heard my voice for a while. I've been quite preoccupied with other things in my personal life, starting a new law firm, and just generally not caring too much about Mormon stuff. I'm not going anywhere, and I hope to be more involved with Infants, but today I'm going to share some audio from a recent event that I was involved with. You may recall me previously referencing in some podcast a community group here in Mesa, Arizona, called the Nautilus Community, which I co-founded. I will probably be doing an episode very soon to explain it more fully, but Nautilus is a secular group made up mostly of ex-Mormons that gets together for events like music, service projects, social activities, and occasionally we even have guest speakers, which is what you're about to hear today. Now you may have heard about the Secular Buddhism podcast, which can be found at secularbuddhism.com. Secular Buddhism is hosted by Noah Rashetta. Noah lives in Utah and is an expert on Buddhism, meditation, mindfulness, and we were thrilled to be able to fly him down to Arizona to speak to our Nautilus community. So what you're about to hear is a clip of Noah Rashetta delivering his talk on secular Buddhism to our community in Mesa, about 60 people that were in attendance that day. He did indulge us for some Q&A at the end. Because of the large room, there's some ambient noise, and I tried to amplify the questions during that portion, but overall the audio quality is not too bad. So if you enjoy this episode, let us know. We may post future audio clips from the Nautilus community if there's things that are of interest. Thanks.
All right. Hello, everyone. Microphone's falling. There we go. Okay, so I've set my timer on my watch. I'm going to attempt in roughly 30 to 35 minutes to present the core fundamental understanding of Buddhist thought that many monks spend their whole life in meditation to understand. And I'm going to leave about 15 minutes for Q&A after. Well, thank you to the Nautilus community for inviting me to be here. I thoroughly enjoy talking about Buddhism and Buddhist thought. And it's always a treat for me to get to share this conversation, share these topics with you. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about Buddhism and says the secret to Buddhism, or the essence of Buddhism, is to eliminate all concepts, all ideas, in order for the truth to have a chance to present itself. And I think that sums up the goal of Buddhism, but then there are a lot of what is truth, what are concepts, what are ideas, and that's kind of what I wanted to focus on today. It's a little bit about the thought behind the process that leads to the contemplative practice of meditation or the practice of Buddhism. So I like to share a story, an experience that I had that I think kind of embodies this teaching. I have a company and I manufacture photography accessories. And I was working with a new supplier for a new product. And when you deal with factories in Asia or in China specifically, they usually have a Western name that they pick. That's their business name, because it's hard for us to pronounce their names. And this new supplier introduced me to their head of sales and development named Chris. And Chris and I spoke for almost a full year by email. And then on a trip to China with my other supplier, I coordinated with Chris to meet at a specific place and a specific time. And when I showed up to this location, Chris wasn't there. And I started pacing, looking at my watch, and 5 minutes went by, 10, 15. And at one point, I finally thought, why isn't Chris here? I would have expected him to be here. And I sat down, a little frustrated that he wasn't there. And you can imagine my surprise when I sat down, and the young girl who had been sitting at that table the whole time on her phone looked up and said, "Oh, hi, Noah, I'm Chris." And I was blown away, and I started to laugh. And I said, I was not expecting that. And it occurred to me in that moment, and in the days after, that is the essence of what Buddhism is teaching. It's that, for me, in that moment, I was literally blind to the reality of who Chris was because of the idea I had of who Chris was. And there she was, and I couldn't see her because I was expecting to see him. And in a very literal way, my ideas and my concepts were blinding me to reality. So what Buddhism alludes to in its teachings is not to engage us with a new set of ideas or beliefs, but to teach us how to unlearn the way that we currently see the world. What it's saying is the problem with Chris being there and me not seeing Chris has nothing to do with Chris, has nothing to do with the location or the time. None of the circumstances with Chris had anything to do with it. It was all here. The problem was the understanding in my mind of the expectation. There's reality and what I hope or expect reality to be, and that's dualistic thinking. In those two worlds of reality and expected reality, you encounter all kinds of problems. And in my case, it was reality sitting there staring at me, and I couldn't see it. So to eliminate concepts and ideas for the truth to have a chance to reveal itself, I want to discuss truth for a little bit. Because from the Buddhist perspective, the understanding of truth is a little different than I think our background in our Western society, the way we understand truths. So I like to explain truths from the perspective of there being two major categories of truths. And I call these empirical truths on one hand and conceptual truths on the other hand. And what this means, an empirical truth, is something that's true regardless of what I believe. And a conceptual truth is a truth that's true because of what I believe. And an example would be typically what you observe in nature, right? Temperature drops to a certain level, water freezes. It doesn't matter if there's human belief involved with that process, that's what's going to happen. That's an empirical truth. Now, a conceptual truth, it's a little more tricky. But an example of a conceptual truth is that the value of gold is greater than the value of silver. And we can all agree that, that can be factual. You can take that to the bank, literally. And at the same time, it's only true because we collectively believe that that's true. You know, if there were no humans on the planet and there's a lump of gold and a lump of silver, there's no inherent value to either one of them, much less that one is worth more than the other. So that's an example of a shared conceptual truth. Now, there are personal conceptual truths as well. For example, hot dogs taste better than hamburgers. You know, some people would agree, and some people would not agree with that. So the world, the realm of truth can get tricky because you may be referring to a personal truth. It may be a shared conceptual truth. It may be an empirical truth, but we treat them all the same. That's kind of where we make the mistake, because my truth is true to me, and I make the mistake of allowing that to conflict with your truth that's true to you. And what Buddhism is trying to help us to understand is we can see through the conceptual truth and understand that the real truth may be that my truth is just as true as your truth, as long as we're talking about the conceptual truths, right? So that's an example of what we're referring to when we say the truth has the ability to emerge, you know, when we can see reality as it is. So I like to clarify that because I think we spend a lot of time, probably the majority of the time of our truths that are touchy truths are all conceptual truths. And the mistake is that we're treating them as empirical truths. So I like to make the distinction between the two. And from the Buddhist perspective, the biggest mistake that we make is the way we perceive reality in terms of space and time. And this is kind of the essence of Buddhist thought. And this is why I wanted to share this specifically, because I think when you understand the description of reality, at least from the Buddhist perspective regarding space and time, all Buddhist teachings will make sense. And that is that in terms of space and in terms of time, all things are impermanent and all things are interdependent. And what that means, let's talk about time for a minute. All things are impermanent, meaning all things are constantly changing. And I had this talk with my son, sitting in the front row, on our way to the airport. And we were talking about death. He had been asking questions about death. And I said, the process of birth and the process of death are one and the same, in the sense that you can't have one without the other. And I said, but we don't have to be sad about it, because what is the death of a caterpillar? And he thinks about it for a minute, and he says, the birth of a butterfly. And I said, do we have to be sad at the death of the caterpillar, or can we be happy at the birth of the butterfly? So we talked about this concept, but the essential teaching is that things continually change. The death of one moment is the birth of the next moment, and that process goes on and on and on. I mean, the fact that I even say that is, I'm not even that same person who just said that a few seconds ago. In a literal way, you know, our physical composition is changing. Cells are dying, cells are regenerating, new cells are born, hair is growing, nails. You know, the whole process of change is continual. So we say that in terms of time, all things are impermanent. And I like to imagine, because we've probably all experienced this at one point or another, but sitting outside and looking at the clouds. And you look at the clouds and what you see is constant change, right? At one point there were no clouds, then the clouds appear, they linger for a while, and then they disappear. And what Buddhism teaches is that's the nature of reality, that's the nature of all things, whether that be our memories, our emotions, our experiences, and life itself functions this very same way, impermanence and constant change. And I like the clouds as an example, because if you look at a cloud, what you see, you'll never look at a cloud and say, well, this one is shaped improperly. And that one's actually right. That's a good cloud. That's a bad cloud. We don't do that, because there's no such thing as a misshapen cloud, right? A cloud is just a cloud. A tree is just a tree. We don't look at a tree and say, well, this one is more straight than that one, so this is the good tree and that's the bad tree. We don't do that. And yet, we do that with each other. There's a right way to be and a wrong way to be, and my way to be and your way to be. So the understanding of impermanence allows us to understand that the nature of reality is continual change. How many of you have played the game of Tetris? Okay. Who hasn't? Who doesn't? Who's not familiar with the game of Tetris? Okay, so the way the game Tetris works is you have shapes that appear on the screen, and you can move them left or right, you can rotate them, and then you want to have them land in a way that you make the whole line complete. And it gets tricky because you never know what shape you're going to get. And life is like the game of Tetris, right? When life presents itself in a way where we don't know what's coming next, and when it does show up, you have limited control over it, and before you know it, the next shape shows up. And we play the game of life as if we had full control. And we're looking at the screen and we're saying, this isn't fair. I wasn't expecting a square. I needed a bar. Or I needed the L shape, whatever that one's called. And that's how we treat life. We look at it thinking, it's not fair. It's supposed to be this way. And we have a really hard time accepting it, that this is what it is. This is the game I have. These are the shapes that I have. And before we know it, a new one shows up. And I think that's at the core of the understanding of impermanence in Buddhist thought. It's that, hey, life presents itself. And you can spend time yelling at the game. You can spend time saying, this isn't fair. Why did he get the square shape when I wanted the square shape? We can do that. But it's not beneficial, right? Because there's still another shape coming. We don't stop that process. So understanding the nature of impermanence allows us to, you know, the expression, go with the flow, to be able to work with what we have, accept what we have, and do the best with what we have, because we start to understand that it's changing. It's changing. It's like the expression, this too shall pass, right? That applies to the good times. Oh, that's kind of sad because they're going to end. But it also applies to the bad times because they're also going to pass. So it allows us to have this ability to be a little bit more neutral because we start to understand that the journey kind of does this. And our mistake is we think it's supposed to do this. And that's where we get caught in that dualistic thinking. And I'll address that after the next topic. So in terms of time, things are impermanent. In terms of space, we say things are interdependent. And this is another powerful way of seeing the world. It's that when we think of something, we think of that thing as independent of all other things. For example, a car. We think of a car and it's this thing. It's real. And at the same time, if I were to take the car and disassemble it into all of its parts and put it out there in the parking lot and ask you which one of those is the car, there isn't one that you can pick and say, this one here, that's the car. No, all of the parts are the car. And interdependence is the understanding that if that's the way a car is, right? A car is the sum total of all of its parts, but everything is the sum total of whatever allows it to be what it is. There's no thing that exists independent of its causes and conditions. This is a teaching in Buddhism that is called dependent origination. And it's the understanding that all things function that way, including the sense of self. I am the sum total of all the things that make me me, but I can't disassemble those and say, there, that one's me. It's not my memories. It's not my physical attributes or my experiences, my emotions. And yet we live as if they are. You know, when I'm experiencing anger, I think I am angry, as if that's something that I am, without understanding that it's something that I'm experiencing. It's a very different thing to understand. You know, the car is not the muffler, but the muffler doesn't work, so we say the car doesn't work, but that's never true, because the car is not the muffler. So interdependence. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about interdependence when he talks about nature, and I really like this example. If you were to look at a flower, he says, when you look at a flower, if the only thing you see is the flower, then you've never actually seen the flower. And people will get confused and say, well, what do you mean? I'm looking at the flower right now. And he'll say, the teaching of interdependence is understanding that the flower does not exist without the sun. It does not exist without the soil. It does not exist without the wind, without the rain, without the bees that cross-pollinate. And, you know, all the elements that are not flower that allow flower to be flower, when you see the flower and you see the totality of it, now you have finally seen the flower. If you only saw the flower, you've never seen the flower. And that's the teaching of interdependence. And I like to apply that to our sense of self, to our sense of other. You know, when we see someone, especially with people, we do this all the time. I see a fixed independent entity, separate from everyone else, and we treat it as such. And the mistake in that view is that you say something offensive to me, and now I'm mad at you, and yet you're not the thing that you do. You know, does that make sense? There's a Zen teaching of a student who comes home and he's upset because something that happened at school, and the dad decides to teach him a lesson about interdependence, and he picks up a little stick and he whacks him with it, and the student or the kid is like, "What are you doing?" And he says, he whacks him again. He's like, "Dad, what are you doing?" He says, "Well, are you mad?" "Yeah, I'm mad. Why are you hitting me?" He says, "Well, are you mad at the stick?" He's like, "No, I'm mad at you. You're the one that hit me." He's like, "Oh, I didn't touch you. The stick hit you." It's like, "Well," and then he goes on to tell him, "Well, are you mad at my hand? My hand's the one holding the stick." It's like, "No, are you mad at my arm? My arm's the one holding the hand." And what he's trying to break down is this understanding of interdependence allows us to start to see that everything that there is, there's something that causes that thing to be. Causes and conditions. You're driving and somebody cuts you off. Are we really mad at the action that happened, or at the story that we immediately create around the action that happened? You know, in that moment, we think, "Oh, this jerk cut me off." And we know nothing about the scenario. Maybe there's someone in the back seat on the way to the hospital. We wouldn't know. And if we did know, it would change everything, wouldn't it? And so it's never the event itself that's the problem. It's the reality we assign to that event becomes the problem. And that's kind of what Buddhist thought is trying to get us to understand, that the problem is never the problem. The problem is what we create around the problem. So those are the two understandings of the world that come from Buddhist thought, is that all things are interdependent and all things are impermanent. Things constantly change and everything is connected to everything. And this has the understanding of these two things allows us to change the way we see reality. And one of the ways that we do that is in Buddhism, we talk about non-dualistic thinking. So dualistic thinking is when we create this and that, self and other, right and wrong, good and bad. And in some aspects, it makes sense to do this, in others it doesn't. And what Buddhism is saying is it never makes sense. For example, the moment I became father is the moment he became son. But I can't have one without the other. And dualistic thinking would put me in the mindset that I can have one without the other. So think about winning and losing. The moment we create the concept of winning is the moment losing also came into existence. And it's only problematic when I want one without the other. We want good, but we don't want bad. We want right, we don't want wrong. We want winning, and we don't want losing. We want happiness, but we don't want sadness. And it's in that dualistic way of viewing the world that we encounter all of our problems. Because the reality is you can't have one without the other. So that form of radical acceptance that we talk about in Buddhism comes from the understanding that these things are one and the same. I can't have one without the other. And then I can appreciate my moments of sadness, my moments of pain, my moments of suffering, because those are the very moments that allow me to understand the moments of happiness, the moments of joy, the moments of laughter. See, you can't have one without the other. And that's the understanding of impermanence. The other implication with this way of thinking is, in Buddhism, what we teach is emptiness. And this one can be tricky because the idea is that all things are empty of meaning. And the typical conclusion is, well, that is a very pessimistic way of seeing the world. There's no meaning. But it's not about emptiness in the sense of nothingness. It's emptiness in the sense of blankness. So imagine a painter with an empty canvas, or an artist who's going to play the piano with a blank sheet of music. You get to create whatever you're going to create on that piece. That's, you can't have that without the emptiness. And what Buddhism teaches is that in life, we're the ones who are assigning meaning to things. And this we see this all the time, going back to truths, right? The conceptual truths. For example, the idea of the ideal body image is a conceptual truth. And it may be that in the specific time and place where we live, we have this idea of this is how I'm supposed to look. And I don't look this way, and now I'm experiencing suffering because I don't fit the idea in my head of how I'm supposed to look. And all along, it's just a conceptual truth. It doesn't mean anything, but it does because I gave it meaning by allowing it to mean something to me. So you can see how quickly what Buddhism is trying to address is that the self-inflicted suffering that we experience in life oftentimes comes not because of the circumstances, but because of our understanding and meaning we've assigned to those circumstances. So those are the key concepts I wanted to kind of specify behind Buddhist thought. Now, obviously, there's a whole lot more to it, but those are the key ones. What's common across any school of Buddhist thought, any Buddhist tradition, Tibetan, Zen, secular Buddhism, the way I teach it, all Buddhism tries to get us to the understanding that all things are impermanent and all things are interdependent. And then the implications of that understanding have to do with how I see myself, how I see others, and the meaning that I assign to life. So that, in a nutshell, is the framework behind Buddhist thought. So before continuing, do you have any questions so far about any of this? Anyone? Okay, back here. Oh, the microphone's coming here.
When do you realize when you've reached enlightenment?
Okay, that's a good question. When do you realize you've reached enlightenment? Now, imagine, so what I mentioned at first, the concept of seeing Chris, right? There's a conceptual idea in my mind of who Chris is. And that is the very thing that will prevent me from seeing who Chris is. Now, enlightenment fits this to a T. Because the moment I have an idea of what it means to be enlightened, I will never be able to experience enlightenment because there's what it is and then there's my expectation of what it is. So in Buddhism, we talk about this idea of enlightenment from the sense that it can't be taught. It can only be experienced. And how will you know? The same way you'll know anything that you know. You'll just know when you know. And that's not a fun answer for a lot of people. It's like, oh, well, great. I don't even know what to look for now, right? But in a way, that's exactly how it is. When my brother was married 3 years before I was, he was kind of ahead in a lot of these life experiences. And when he had his first daughter, I thought, oh, this is kind of what it must be like to be a dad, because I'm kind of just like him. And yeah, this must be what it's like. And 3 years later, I became a dad. I was like, oh, this is what it's like to be a dad. You know, it can't be conveyed except through experience. And life itself is experiential. You know, all of our experiences in life function this way. What is it like to lose a job? Well, you have to lose a job to find out. What is it like to be deceived or lied to or hurt or loved or any of these things? You can't fully understand it unless you experience it. So back to what is enlightenment? Well, enlightenment is enlightenment. That would be the Buddhist answer, right? But I'm going to try to explain it a little bit more because in the historical account, the Buddha, who was a teacher, in Buddhism, the Buddha is not a deity. He was a teacher who taught how to attain enlightenment. So it's like, how do you teach how to attain something that I can't tell you what it is? Well, good, that's, you know, that's fine. We've had 2,500 years to try to figure that out. So what happened is, at one point in his meditation, he was trying to obtain happiness, like we all are. And the way the story goes is that he lived a privileged life. He was a prince, and he had everything he needed, and he realized he was still concerned about things like old age, sickness, and death. So he leaves the palace, and he goes on this four-year meditation thing in the forest, and he gives up everything, and he's trying to literally give up everything. And in that process, he discovers having everything didn't make me happy, and giving up everything didn't make me happy. So what do I do? And so he starts sitting there, and he's meditating, and in that moment, he realizes, oh, the problem isn't how do I obtain happiness, it's how can I be okay with not obtaining happiness? Realizing it's all along, the point was that there is no point. And that's the moment he became enlightened. It's realizing there's nothing to get. And that's the irony. Like, the greatest thing you'll ever get is that there's nothing to get. And that is the enlightenment of the Buddha that he taught you know, from that moment on, where he's like, hey, the problem isn't that you can't get what you're trying to get. The problem is that you're trying to get it in the first place, because all things are interdependent and all things are impermanent. So that elusive thing that you think you can get, you can't get, because the moment you got it, it's gone. That was the whole point. That's the understanding of impermanence. Does that kind of answer the question? Okay. Here and then there.
So regarding this principle of impermanence, it feels to me that, like, the principle of Buddhism requires a pretty advanced or maybe not sort of cognitive abilities. So what would Buddhism say about, like, children who are suffering? I mean, what answers? I mean, I could say, like, hey, child, this is going to pass. So, you know, maybe I don't have the motivation to do anything to end pain and suffering, right? Because it's sort of like a cyclical thing. So how do you, how does Buddhism view that? What obligations do we have, and how do we help kids?
Okay, good question. So the Buddhist understanding, as far as ethics in general, I think, kind of falls along the lines of the golden rule. And it's kind of reversed, because in Buddhism it was taught, don't cause harm to others the way that you would want harm. It's from the perspective of don't cause harm to others. So the whole aim of Buddhism is to eliminate or reduce suffering, the suffering that we experience, but also the suffering that anyone else experiences. And I think there's the tendency to think that the conclusion in Buddhism is that you just allow things to just be, like, oh, it is what it is. And that's not necessarily true. I think there's a high level of activism in Buddhism to eliminate the suffering that we see in the world. With children specifically, with humans specifically, but all sentient beings, there's the sense of how do we help eliminate the suffering. Now, what we would distinguish here is the type of suffering that we're talking about. Because there's suffering that's natural. The suffering of loss, the suffering of falling out of a tree and breaking your arm would be examples of the type of suffering that, hey, this will pass. It's okay, I'm here with you. But then there's a type of suffering that we call all-pervasive suffering. And this is the sense of suffering that's self-inflicted and we don't realize it's self-inflicted. The aim of Buddhist thought is to eliminate that third type of suffering. You know, the suffering of a child who thinks, at school, people are calling me names and now I'm believing that. And, you know, that's the type of suffering that we would absolutely address with vigor, because that's self-inflicted suffering. These are conceptual truths that are causing us to suffer. So that's kind of the difference. I think there's a high level of activism in Buddhism to eliminate the suffering that we experience in the world. Does that answer that?
Yeah.
Okay. Olivia, did you have a question? Okay, she just wanted to say something.
So once me and my dad watched a video where there were these monks and they were making a really cool painting that looked like it would take a long time to make out of sand. And then they broke it to teach themselves that nothing lasts forever.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, those are called mandalas. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, they'll spend hours and days and even months crafting this elaborate drawing out of sand, usually patterns, just so that when they're done, they just wipe it all off the table, start all over. It's like building those big puzzles, you know? We kind of do that, I guess, those 1,000-piece puzzles, and the moment you're done, put it all back in the box. I want to do this again. And they do that because it's a reminder to themselves that all things are impermanent. No matter how important it was while I was doing it, it's still not going to last forever. And that makes it okay when those moments pass and you wipe all that sand away, because it was understanding that the joy was the process. The joy wasn't the finished result. The joy was the process. Thank you, Olivia. Okay, right here.
What techniques do you have to train yourself back to your thoughts when life is coming at you? Because it's one thing for us to all sit here and say, oh, yeah, if I was having this problem, then I could take this way.
Mm-hmm.
But then, when your husband calls you and says, I'm losing my job, what? how do you go, okay, this is happening. Do you have any techniques that can draw you back to centeredness when life truly throws the curveballs in?
Yeah, good question. Viktor Frankl talks about the space between stimulus and response. When something happens and we respond right away, there may not be a space in between. It happens so fast that I'm already responding, and then later I'm thinking, why didn't I just sit with that for a minute? Well, it's too late. I already threw the dishes, or I already did whatever. But the first step of the process is recognizing that I wasn't able to be with it. So in Viktor Frankl's work talks about that space and how you practice spreading that gap between stimulus and response. This is why meditation plays an important role in Buddhism. What we're practicing in meditation is being with what is. We're trying to anchor ourselves in the present moment. Now, I think a misconception is thinking that we're actually doing something. Like, I'm sitting here and I'm doing something and something's supposed to happen. That goes back to the example earlier of I'm creating a concept, an idea of what it is, and now I'm not gonna get the benefit of what it actually is, which is you're just being with the moment. That's what you're practicing. We're not good at that in general. And even when we start practicing, the first thing that we'll notice is that we're not good at that. And that can frustrate us because we're like, oh, well, this is impossible. Well, the first step was noticing that seems impossible, right? So what we practice, the technique of sitting, is I'm becoming comfortable with discomfort. I'm allowing myself to sit here thinking, I don't have time to sit here. I don't have time. You know, I've got to be doing this. And I watch myself, and I watch the mind just skipping from racing from one thing to the next. And in that moment, what you're really practicing is observing. So from the Buddhist perspective, we have two mindsets. There's the mind that's looking out, and then there's the mind that's looking in. It's looking in is like the observing mind. Looking out is the thinking mind. And we experience most of life in this active mode, thinking, doing, reacting, responding. And we rarely practice observing. So the first step of observing would be observing that I'm not observing, right? And then you keep practicing that. And at some point, what you experience by practicing observing is that something will happen. There is the trigger or the catalyst of what happens, and you catch it. And you think, oh. And it'll happen like this. You'll think, how interesting, I am experiencing anger. And it's very intense, and I actually want to kill this person. And you'll think, how interesting that I can at least observe that. And that's what you practice, observing and recognizing, well, if I can observe this, my brother Nick called me one day on the road saying, I was sitting here and the car cut me off, and I thought, first I noticed how angry I got, but then I noticed, is the me that's observing the angry me also angry? And that's that first step of thinking, oh, well, if the observer's neutral, then what is it? Am I actually mad, or is that just the emotion I'm experiencing? So in a way, I guess what I'm trying to say is in those moments, we observe. But we don't try to block what's actually happening, because we're not trying to pretend that we're not mad. That's not beneficial. What we're trying to do is just observe. And the more we practice observing, the more space we create between the stimulus and the response. So I hope that kind of helps. I guess what I would say is what we practice is meditating. That's why we spend a lot of time sitting and just being with something. Even if what that is sitting there and being with the fact that I don't want to sit there and meditate. Okay.
Does Buddhism recognize reincarnation? Tell me about that.
Reincarnation?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a good question. The Buddhist tradition emerges around the same time that the Hindu tradition emerges. And the Vedantic ideology of the time accepted the fact that, or believed in reincarnation, that the way you live now will influence the way you live in the future, and you come back in a different form. But early Buddhism, and Buddhism in general, does not view reincarnation in the sense of the me that's me comes back as another thing. We call it rebirth. And the idea, like I mentioned before, the idea is just constant change. So in that sense, what it's saying is you're reincarnating, you're not reincarnating, but you're constantly changing. So the me that was me 5 seconds ago is not the same me as now. And the implication of that in the long term, like what happens when I die, that kind of question, it's saying what happens is change. Change is what happens. So if the me that's conscious me now, I can't know what the non-conscious existing version of me is because that's not me. I only am what I am. It's kind of like the analogy of the caterpillar and the butterfly. The caterpillar cannot know what it is to be a butterfly, but the butterfly can. And so we don't teach. I've never encountered the teaching of reincarnation in Buddhism like you hear about it in Hinduism. It says, you know, you'll come back as this animal or something like that. The Buddhist approach does not delve with the existential questions of what happens after life. It's completely concerned with the present moment. How do we eliminate suffering in the present moment? And in fact, it'll kind of allude to the fact that if you're distracting yourself with the existential questions, then you're not addressing the situation at hand, which is that there is suffering in the here and now. That's really the only thing Buddhism is concerned with. Okay, any other questions? Okay, back here.
In my religion, my concept, I guess, I believe in a deity, and I pray to that deity, and I find peace. Buddhism, it sounds like it's more of a little bit of scientific and accepting how the world is made up of opposites. And once you accept that, you find your peace. But I've seen in Buddhism, I'm very ignorant of Buddhism, but I've seen in movies where people pray to Buddha. Is that correct? Or that
correct? No, that's incorrect. So we talk about prayer in Buddhism, and the understanding of what prayer is from the Eastern thought is pretty different from the Western understanding of prayer. So a Buddhist prayer is more like, may all beings be happy, may all beings be free from suffering. It's an expression of my wishes, but it's not directed to anyone or to anything. It's more of my desire for how I am and how my interaction with others is my prayer, but it's never directed at someone. Thank you.
When you talk about everything being devoid of meaning and like the blank slate, how does Buddhism offer any like action steps or ideas towards finding joy, happiness, avoiding complacency? Like,
what are the goals that you aspire to besides not suffering?
Is there meaning beyond us all not suffering? Or how do we create meaning within Buddhist thought?
Yeah, so what Buddhism is trying to instill in us is the understanding that because we create our meaning, now we have the ability to experience contentment with the process. It kind of talks about it like using artists as an example. The joy of an artist who paints is the painting. The process of painting is the joy. In that process, there is suffering. You know, I run out of paint, I'm frustrated, I need to go to the paint store. You know, all of that is part of the overall experience. So while they'll experience suffering, they don't view suffering as bad. You wouldn't view suffering as that kind of suffering, at least. It's that would be part of the process. So the joy and the contentment is the process itself. So what we would say is, if you're thinking that I need to paint so that I can finally have it done and say, look what I did, and that's where I get my joy, when you guys say, wow, that's an incredible painting, that's an unwise way of finding joy. Because if I just enjoy it for the fact of painting, now there's no problem with the outcome. You know, the bird that sings because it's what a bird does enjoys the process of singing, and it's not concerned if everyone walks out the moment I start singing. It's like, well, they don't like my voice, because the goal was never to sing to make you enjoy the song. The bird just sings because it's what it does. That's kind of the lesson, the Buddhist understanding of the art of learning to live is that you learn to live for the sake of living. you find joy in the process of living. So there, it's, I think a misconception could be there's no interest in finding joy, but that's not true. It's saying the joy will come as a result of understanding I didn't need to chase after the joy. It's going to happen because it's going to happen. Just like sadness too, right? I can fight everything to ensure I never experience sadness, and I'll still experience sadness. It's saying the opposite is also true. And there's a teaching in Buddhism that when it's talking about enlightenment or about joy, it's like you can chase a butterfly in a field all you want with your bare hand, and you're just not going to catch it. But the moment you sit down, it might come and land right on your nose. And that's kind of the Buddhist view of life. You enjoy the process. Does that kind of answer that? Okay.
Answer. Can you be a Buddhist and seek after high financial goals? Can you be a Buddhist and seek it? I don't know, the things that you want, you really bad. Or can you be at home and do nothing on the couch and be a successful Buddhist, or be the most successful CEO and be a Buddhist? Is it just because you assign the meaning to it? And then you accept that there's going to be ups and downs with whatever you choose to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just love the process of you deciding how you're going to live your life and whatever you choose.
Yeah, I think what it's trying to get at in that scenario is for you to ask yourself, why am I doing what I'm doing? And if I'm chasing after high financial goals, for example, it's not that there's anything wrong with chasing after anything. It's just saying at least know why you're doing it. Because if you're chasing after high financial goals because you think that's going to ensure that you experience happiness and not sadness, then you're fooling yourself because there's no way around that. If you can accept that the nature of reality is that I will experience both, then go ahead and do whatever it is that you want to do, knowing that even though I'm doing this and chasing these goals, I'm still at times going to experience suffering, experience sadness, happiness, because that's all part of the process. So it allows you the freedom to enjoy the process, whatever the process is. That's kind of the beauty of it. You get to choose the process. If you want to aspire to be a CEO and have a company and a lot of finances, that's fine. There's not a right or a wrong. It's just saying, understand that the nature of reality is that there's no guarantee against. The mistake we make sometimes in life is that we do those things thinking that this will eliminate suffering in life. And then that's where you encounter problems because you still experience the suffering. You know, with money, fame, wealth, power, those are typical ones that the famous and the wealthy and the powerful all experience suffering very much the same way we do.
Sorry, not
at all.
I was listening to this book called Subtle Art of Not Giving a Net by Martinez and he says, choose your own problems. Like lots of people say, everyone wants to do money, such a relationship, etc. He's like, what's a more interesting question is, what problems do you want to have? Does that fit any way into the Buddhist thing? It's like, we know we're all going to have problems, so we try to pick a path that has problems that we want to have.
Yeah.
You know?
I like that framing. I think
problems.
That fits.
As a married person, they have problems.
Mm-hmm.
People are picking their lifestyle, what problems they want to have.
Yeah.
Activities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I like that framing of it too, but I think that's exactly kind of what it alludes to, as saying the problem isn't the problem. The problem is you think that you're going to avoid the problem. So if you recognize there's a problem, work with your problem, pick your problem. You know, that whole idea works very well with that way of thinking. Yeah. And just to kind of more background on, I have my own company and I manufacture products. I have financial goals and milestones that my company tries to hit. You know, I don't run my company like a Buddhist monastery where it's like, whatever goes is whatever goes. You know, we don't do that. We have milestones that we have to hit. We have expenses that need to be accounted for and sales, you know. So I think the difference is, in Buddhism we say wisdom is the ability to adapt. Wisdom is being able to play Tetris and not freak out when that next piece shows up, because I learned early on that life is Tetris. That's kind of what Buddhism is saying. So in that context, I can allow myself to pursue my financial goals with my business And then when a big deal falls through, like they do, I immediately adapt and say, oh, okay, well, let's move on to what I need to do. You know, I'm not going to get stuck saying that was not supposed to happen. This is unfair. Poor me. You know, because you just stay in that suffering longer. You can accept it and say, well, that's what it is, and move on to the next thing quicker. Does that make sense? Okay. Any other questions? So that was the 45-minute mark on my phone, on my watch. But what I guess my main goal with this was to introduce these overarching topics, that life is impermanent, all things are impermanent, all things are interdependent. Now, what you do with that going forward is look at things and break them down. You know, this thing that seems permanent, look at it and say, what are the causes and conditions of that thing? When I experience a specific emotion, try to be with it for a minute, even if it's after the fact, and say, why was I so angry when this or that happened? And just a quick example, applying this in my personal practice, you know, coming home from work one day and my wife was upset that I forgot to take out the trash because it gets picked up really early and now we don't have anywhere to put it. The way she expressed it to me made me upset at her. And before I knew it, 2 or 3 hours into this, I'm sitting there fuming on the couch, and it occurred to me, this has nothing to do with the trash. I'm looking for the causes and conditions of things. You know, am I mad because of something past that was said or done? Am I mad because, and in this case, I was able to pinpoint, I got in a bad mood from an email that came earlier in that morning from work that has nothing to do with family, and that's dictated my mood for the day. And at least I was able to pin it and stop it there. And not say that it was wrong, but just to recognize how interesting. One email changed my day, and maybe I'll start fresh again tomorrow. And it didn't immediately put me in a good mood, but it made me realize the nature of reality is that's how life works. All these integral little things are happening, and the mistake that you can make is thinking, I'm mad at you because you yelled at me for not taking out the trash. And you realize, well, it never had anything to do with the trash. That's kind of the practice. Applied to just an example in my own life. So if you want to learn more about these ideas, I have a podcast called the Secular Buddhism Podcast where I take much more time breaking down all of the different concepts of Buddhist teachings and Buddhist thought. And it's compatible with any ideology or beliefs because, like I mentioned at first, Buddhism isn't about giving you a new set of beliefs. It's about giving you the set of tools to scrutinize the way you see the world. And to be able to look at something and say, is the problem the something, or is the problem the way I view the something? And I talk about all that in my podcast. If you look for Secular Buddhism on iTunes or any podcast directory, you'll find it. And I just talk about different topics that may or may not be useful for you, but it talks about Buddhism. So if you're interested in learning about these concepts in Buddhism, that's one way to do it. And then, of course, there are tons of really good books out there on this topic. But I guess what I want to say is you don't need to view Buddhism as this thing that's out there that, oh, I shouldn't learn that because I'm already this or that. Buddhism is very compatible with anything because it's secular in nature. It's not about ideas, it's about how are my ideas preventing me from seeing what's really there. And what I would hope for you is that you have an experience similar to my experience with Chris, that in some way, something in life that's been that way all along will suddenly emerge, and you'll say, oh, that's what it was all along, and the only reason I couldn't see it is because of the idea or concept that I held that was blinding me from that reality. Oh, of course.
My question about Buddhism, when you first talked about alleviating suffering, the first thing that comes to mind is avoidance and trying to avoid suffering.
Mm-hmm.
After listening to you a little bit, I thought this would figure out that's not really what you meant. Would it be more correct to think of it as embracing it as part of the process?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a teaching in Buddhism about suffering that says when you're experiencing it, the last thing you want to do is fight it off. You want to allow it in and say, what is this suffering I'm experiencing? Where is it coming from? How can I get comfortable with it? Have compassion for it. Treat it like it's this old friends. Hey, you're back. Come here. Let's sit down and talk. Why are we feeling this way? You know, because resisting it is what is probably the worst thing we could do. In Buddhism, we say the definition of suffering is wanting life to be other than it is. And if suffering is how it is and I want it to be other than it is, I'm only adding suffering to the suffering. It can become cyclical, right? So we sit with it and we allow it to be what it is. And instead of treating it like it's this thing I don't want, we can say it's this thing that's here, so let's look into it, spend time with it. Thank you for bringing that up.
And then just one quick follow-up question. Is there any books out there you could recommend for somebody who's wanting to start learning about Buddhism?
Yes, so there are several. It kind of depends. I have some that I recommend depending on the background of where someone is. If you like the secular approach to Buddhism, there's a book called Buddhism Without Beliefs by Stephen Batchelor. That was a really good one that I enjoyed. There's one called Joyful Wisdom by a long Tibetan name. But just look up Joyful Wisdom and the name that looks really weird, that's it. those are two that I can think of off the top of my head that are good introduction. Very good introductory books to Buddhism. You're welcome. Okay, well, I think that is it then. I don't know if we do something after this. Thank you guys for coming. I know a lot of you came from different places, so thank you for taking the time to come here. And I look forward to meeting several of you after that I've interacted with online, but first time to meet in person. So thanks again.
Hi, this is Sam from Wilmer, Minnesota. On weekdays, I prosecute criminals for crimes like domestic abuse, production of methamphetamine, and sexual assault. On Sundays, I learn about the things that are truly evil in this world, like gay people getting married, consumption of coffee, and bare shoulders. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, you can give the Korma 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Okay. Can you, if I say something, can you say it for me?
Yeah.
Say, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
To Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.
Okay, now say it all together. Say, thank you for listening to... No, wait until I'm done. Say, thank... No, wait until I'm done, okay? I'll say it, and then it'll be your turn, okay?
Okay.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.
Thrones.
Okay, you say the whole thing.
Thank you for listening on Thrones.
Okay, say, thank you for listening...
On Thrones.
No. Listen, say what I say. Thank you for listening
to Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.
No.